Now, a special Fry's English Delight. Sharpen your pencils, pay strict attention now. What follows contains hidden clues, buried answers, and difficult riddles, though not always in that order. Here's Stephen Fry explaining why word games matter.
You know, it's possible to argue that world civilization itself was solved in part by that most sophisticated and English of word games, the cryptic crossword puzzle. We will hear how later. Oh, did I say solved? Freudian slip. I meant saved. But words have a kittenish habit of playing with each other in our minds, almost unbidden, as we'll hear. To start, a historic achievement in the paradoxically silent word game charades, later known as Give Us a Clue.
Fans still speak in hushed tones of the day. Eunice Stubbs, her hands a blur, managed three men in a boat in less than 90 seconds.
Oh, dear. A sound charade from I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, recalled by the late Humphrey Littleton, prompting one to reflect that live dirt up a sidetrack carted is a putrid evil. Thanks to Tony Ogard, writer of the Oxford Guide to Word Games, for that palindrome, although 17th-century English composer Henry Purcell created his favourite.
Egad, a bass tone denotes a bad age.
Satan, oscillate my metallic sonatas.
And that reads exactly the same backwards as forwards. You've got pangrams, which is where you try to compose a sentence containing all the letters of the alphabet, but preferably only once each, and nobody's actually devised a perfect pangram.
Yet we still continue to try. All languages and culture are riddled with, well, riddles. They have, in myth and reality, changed the world. Oedipus saved Thebes by solving the riddle of the Sphinx. Who walks on four in the morning, then two, then three? Well, here's an interesting variation from an official enigmatist, Chris Maslanka, who will be joining us for the duration of the programme. But Chris, your riddle is a sort of distant relative to the Oedipal one, isn't it?
This one is a Hungarian one. These are set traditionally by prospective father-in-laws who want to size up whether this chap has come to the village. Is yeah. a waste of time or not? Are they pig ignorant? Do they understand animal husbandry as well as husbandry? So this one is 10 pulling 4. So the task is to find a situation that fits.
Right, 10 pulling 4. There's the riddle, and you can think about it throughout the rest of the programme. But is English innately more playful than any other languages? Only in England, you might think, would an Oxford College, St Catherine's, make this appointment.
St Catherine's College, Oxford, made me their enigmatist. There's never been a post like it in history. I'm the first one in the world. It's unpaid, unfortunately. I was asked this question by the Duke of Edinburgh, and he snorted as if to say it was not worth doing. But it's honorific, and I like it.
As part of your role, you've created a time capsule, is that right?
Well, I didn't create the capsule. I was summoned by the master, and I was shown these mystery objects. My job is to issue clues, so it has to be mantic and complicated. So it's a bit like the Delphic Oracle. I have to say mantic things
right.
twice a year. Which
mantic
seems to be,
and gnomic.
Yes, which suits me fine. But, of course, there is the nightmare that only two people in the world know what's in there. Or indeed where it is. And I had this nightmare, recurrent nightmare, where I'm driving into the college too fast, the master's driving out too fast, and we both eliminate each other, and it'll be completely forgotten.
That's
a responsibility.
In a way, it's a test of the college's right to exist. Will it, in future generations, have people bright enough to work out somehow what you've done?
Well, people do have a head start, after all, and they know it can't be a cheese. That would be a joke too far.
But bad jokes, puns, word games, acrostics, puzzles, cryptic crosswords, board games, acting games, they seem very, very English somehow, don't they? So does our language lend itself in particular to word games?
The amount of words there are in the language and the richness of them and the shades of meaning, the way that some words are only very slightly different from another and yet the meaning seems to be a chasm apart. We'd all like to think that English innately lends itself particularly well to word games. Linguists will tell you that's not true probably, but that's my feeling.
Juliet Gardner, social historian and word game fan, who'll help us with word games' 20th century history. And we will have a linguist to examine whether our language is, by nature, game for a game. We'll also ask, do we divide into word gamers and number crunchers? Sudoku versus Sudoku, so to speak. Here's Phil Jupiters, backstage at a professional word game.
I like doing both. I like doing them back to back. Lots of people do, and I think that is why the newspapers put the Sudoku. Please, any Japanese listening, help us out on this pronunciation, because we are a divided organisation here at the Comedy Store Players. Sudoku, Sudoku. Let's call the whole thing off. But Sudoku's, you know, a logic puzzle, and then you massage a different part of your brain. You massage the word part. I think it's just a way of massaging the left and right side of the brain.
Phil Jupiter's brains speaking there. And while we're at the Comedy Store, we'll see how games enjoy a teasingly delightful relationship with improvised comedy.
We are in a tradition of English-British word games, but you're going to hear later a particularly obvious word game in that you're only allowed to say one word at a time, so that really is a word game. So you'll have to leap into a whole new universe because you heard cheese and that makes you think of Bromley.
Neil Malarkey, also of the Comedy Store Players, on the relationship between word games and improvisation, cheese and Bromley. Cheese does seem to be emerging as a theme, but in terms of our puzzles, it's a red herring. Later, another cheese association word-based game.
Sheila, Fazzini.
It must be a font. There can't be a cheese called Fazzini.
I'm thinking it's an Italian singer.
Brand new cheese or font. Now, nobody said this was going to be easy or cheesy. Alongside the analysis, there will be more challenges. Listen to this poem, if poem it is.
Woven silk pyjamas exchanged for blue quartz. Waxy and quivering, jocks fumble pizza. Sexy zebras just prowl and vie for quick, hot matings. Judges vomit. Few quiz pharynx block. Quick, wafting zephyrs vex, bold Jim.
Right. Now link the music to the words. In fact, you've heard the answer already. Now to that very big question. Is English, by its nature, a playful language? Guy Deutscher is a linguist and honorary research fellow at the School of Languages, Linguistics and Culture at the University of Manchester.
It's definitely a legitimate question whether it is a significant factor in bringing about the well-known playfulness, wit, irony, and so on of the English. We know that one's mother tongue certainly can affect the way one thinks and it can affect aspects of the culture. It's a very reasonable thing to ask whether humour or wit is one of those areas where the properties of the language itself affects thought and culture.
But does the way we speak somehow shape who we are? French prides itself on clarity. German has a reputation for orderliness. Italian for beauty. Orthodox linguistics says that the basis of all language grammar is somehow hardwired and that the structural diversity of world languages is irrelevant, superficial. We all, whatever language we speak, carry the same mental toolkit, so we shape our language rather than our language shaping us. To challenge this, a game. You must call anything you mention, any noun, Mr. or Miss. Would you like a nice Miss Steak and Mr. Chips? Or should male plurals be Messrs? Messrs. Trousers? It seems foreign. And of course it is. More than half the world does this without thinking, including Guy Deutscher, whose mother tongue is Hebrew.
So for me, a bed is feminine, a table is masculine, a bird is feminine no matter what, you know, the accidents of its anatomy are. Poets of languages with gender systems like this have drawn on these chains of associations that are in some sense imposed on the speakers by the language in their imagery. When Baudelaire, for example, talks in his poem about the man and the sea, there's no way that you can transfer the associations that he creates in the French, where the man is masculine and the sea is feminine. It's clearly playing on the relation between a man and a woman. And this definitely shows that there are idiosyncrasies of each language which affects the way that the speakers think.
So a feature of gendered language makes people think and feel in a particular way. And in that example, the proof emerges in poetry.
So in theory, one could ask whether there are any idiosyncrasies about English that encourage its particular playfulness.
Tony Ogard, author of The Oxford Guide to Word Games and other related titles, got interested in the subject when he worked at that great lexicographical coalface, the Oxford English Dictionary.
I think there's a link here between writing dictionaries and getting involved in word games, because you see, in a way, the intricacies of words once you start looking at words, trying to define them, trying to find out what they mean, but also looking at their history. Probably because we started with the Saxons and then we built upon that from various borrowings from other countries.
So English's famous size and diversity, its hunger for new words, makes it a playful language. Perhaps. Here's a case study, one of those what am I riddles. I am a wildebeest or African antelope, fairly commonplace, but I shot to stardom in the 1920s thanks to the crossword. An American invention which seized on one of my attributes. Not my beard or stooped neck, something else, according to social historian and word games enthusiast Juliet Gardner.
Three-letter words particularly difficult. There's a sort of limit on the number of three-letter words, and that's probably what popularised it. I'm not sure that most of us today would know. It must have been the compiler's dream.
Of course, my fame was much later sealed by a hit comic song, but my original entry into the language was courtesy of the crossword puzzle.
Partly because it's a three-letter word, and partly because, of course, how do you pronounce it? And so many words like that, of course, you don't pronounce the first letter, and that's so enriching. It's such a funny word. You were searching all the time for words that nobody knew.
What am I?
I'm a gnu. I'm a gnu. The nicest worker of nature in the zoo. I'm a gnu. How do you do? You really ought to know wahoo's wahoo.
I'm not sure that Flanders and Swan would have picked it up if gnu hadn't featured in crossword puzzles.
Were it not for my three-letteredness and the 1920s crossword boom, I would still be an anonymous blue wildebeest without a hit song to my name. Funny how fame works. But there. Does this story prove that English's thirst for new words and ever-swelling vocabulary mean English is the gamest of tongues? Don't ask me. I'm a gnu. But I'll stop being one now. Here is Guy Deutscher again. English, measured by the size of the Oxford English Dictionary, is bigger than most languages. So does that mean more to play with?
I don't think really that argument stands, because if you look at not the amount of words that officially exist through the history of a language, which is what the Oxford English Dictionary records, but the amount of words that an average speaker or even an educated speaker would recognize, not to mention use actively, this would be just a fraction of this huge number.
English does have a slightly greater level of homonymy than other European languages. Words with different meanings spelled the same or that sound the same. Very handy when it comes to wordplay.
If the degree of homonymy in a language was really the indicator for how playful it is, then we would have a language like Chinese being far above any European language that we can think of. And so the Chinese should have far superior humour to anyone else. But I think more importantly, you don't even need real homonymy. You don't really need two words that sound exactly the same in order to play on them. And puns and other word games quite often use words that sound similar. And words that sound similar but have different meanings exist in absolutely every language.
What about the sophistication with which we listen, the subtlety with which we interpret? Now to a game which can demonstrate this. Cheese or font? You have to guess whether a word refers to a typographical font or a lactobacillic cheese, just by the sound of it. We've assembled experts to play this. Indeed, this is really pro-celebrity cheese or font, because we have best-selling miscellanist Ben Schott, who typesets all his own books, and Sheila Dillon of Radio 4's food programme, who eats all her own cheese. The words are read by Harriet Cass.
Ben, Humboldt Fogg.
Sounds like an excuse for one of Sherlock Holmes's detectives to get away. I think that's probably a cheese, although Humboldt does sound fontish. I were going to go for cheese.
It's a cheese. You're
excellent.
Right.
That's a relief.
Sheila, Valskum.
Valskum.
Here are the keen-eared players. Look for the subtlest of signals Valskum. In the game.
Valskum. Cheese. These are very obscure.
I'd say cheese.
You're right. It's a cheese. It's a cheese. Now, I'm going to have to be careful how I say this. Sheila, Arshia.
Can you spell it?
A-R-S-H-I-A. Arshia.
I'd say it was a font, then.
I don't know. I haven't heard of it as a font. I'm going to say it's a cheese.
It's a font. And Sheila, finally, Dauphin.
Dauphin. I think that's a font.
I think it's a font.
You're both right and both wrong.
It's both.
It's a cheese and a font.
That rarest of phenomena, lactotypographical homonymy, or chont. But, sad to say, English probably isn't the subtlest of languages. In fact, according to Guy Deutscher, capacious, highly literate languages aren't any more subtle or complex than small oral ones. Sadly, then, we have to answer our first question in the negative. English is no more playful than any other language. Its size, proneness to accident, alleged sophistication, all fail the test. But let's assume, at least, that word games are good for you. Here's social historian Juliet Gardner on their great period of growth, the 1920s.
People were opening up their houses so they could have house parties, weekend parties, not that you called it weekend because that wasn't smart because that suggested you had to go to work on a Monday. Treasure hunts were terribly popular. The point about word games is the idea is that they're inclusive, but also, of course, they can kind of be exclusive. They can be a kind of a private language. And I think a lot of young people in the 20s and 30s wanted to sort of form cliques and coteries, and word games, in a sense, were like a password to a particular sort of society. The popular press was really taking off, and there were these circulation wars, and so, of course, crosswords was a way of doing that. You offered more and more generous prizes. You know, had better and cleverer crosswords, and people learned all sorts of words that they had never even known about, things like acnestis, which was, I think, is the part of your back that you can't actually scratch.
And I hope you're by now itching to interrogate our earlier claim that world civilization was saved by the crossword puzzle, which appeared first in America in 1913 and boomed in the 20s. Compilers in Britain developed cryptic versions, but by the 1940s, we British were complaining that they weren't cryptic enough. The Daily Telegraph responded with a competition. Historian and journalist Sinclair Mackay takes up the story.
20, I think, competitors were assembled in the newsroom of the Daily Telegraph in January 1942. The challenge was to solve the cryptic crossword in under 12 minutes. A number of the competitors did, and subsequently the War Office contacted them and asked them if they would be inducted into the mysteries of Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park was the great code-breaking centre of World War II, and it was at Bletchley Park where they smashed the Enigma codes, which the Germans considered to be completely insoluble. So Bletchley Park required bright young people who were very swift and clever with crosswords and with word games, because that in itself demonstrated a certain level of lateral thinking. Also together with that was a certain kind of state of mind. They knew the immensity of the work they were doing. They knew the enormous pressure that they were under. No one could ever solve a crossword, one veteran told me, if you had a gun pointing at your head. And the same pretty much was true for codes, that you had to get into that particular state of mind that perhaps you might find in a cryptic crossword solver as well. It's intense concentration. You're shutting everything else out. And you are focusing, but relaxing at the same time. It is detachment, isn't it? It's a particular skill.
Sinclair Mackay, author of The Secret Life of Bletchley Park. The crossword-solving mind. Thorough, considered, perceptive, and detached. Christmas Lanker.
These higher levels, which bring in all the different aspects of words, the references, the meanings, the subtleties, they are not just a testament of how well you can speak, but also how well you can think, and in particular, how fluid your framing.
Could these properties we associate with puzzles, fluidity, detachment, analysis, be therapeutic? Dr. Emily Holmes, clinical psychologist and senior research fellow at the University of Oxford's Department of Psychiatry, has tested games in the possible treatment of people with post-traumatic stress disorder. In particular, how to help them detach from nasty flashbacks. In a simulation, healthy subjects are shown a horror film, the kind with horrid after effects. Soon after, they're asked to play one of two games. The useful effects of Tetris, a kind of animated jigsaw played against the clock, are compared with a verbal game.
What we think they do is tap into different sorts of human memory processing. The Tetris game taps into very visual memory, whereas the pub quiz game taps into verbal memory, more conceptual. It's about words and meaning. Okay, so would these two games have a different impact on the development of flashbacks to the horrible movie in the subsequent week? Simply doing something one enjoys isn't always helpful. And traumatic memory takes the form of images. So it makes sense that if you disrupt your ability to lay down image-based memory by a Tetris game, you'll get less flashback. Let's switch now to the verbal game. One of the important things after trauma is to be able to conceptually and verbally make sense of what happened. And what we know is that our memory is still consolidating and being laid down for approximately 6 hours after a trauma. So if we're playing, asking people to play these games at 4 hours, that's still in a stage where memory is quite malleable. And if you play a verbal game, what our prediction is that you're disrupting with the kind of conceptual processing that's needed to make sense of a sudden and distressing traumatic event.
So in that particular case, shape games won, word games nil. We used to connect therapeutic word association games with Viennese psychiatrists' pince-nez and pointy beards. They revealed your innermost thoughts, supposedly. Those games are now the preserve of another form of madness, improvised comedy. Neil Malarkey of the Comedy Store Players.
There's a lot of association, word association or idea association. Somebody will say a word and then somebody will take it in this area and then the person who said it is obviously thinking, well, that's not what I meant by that, but OK, I'll go with it. So we do enjoy the misunderstanding or the misinterpretation or different interpretations of words. The game's called Three-Headed Expert. One person interviews those three. Those three can say one word at a time as if they were three bodies, one voice.
And the three-headed expert in question trains armadillos for Olympic crown green bowling. Don't ask.
Rolling!
An
armadillo!
Down! The
grassy hillock
is
better
than rolling
a
ball.
Why?
Naturally,
they
are slower,
but
more
amusing.
I've
got
four
children.
And
one
wife.
Now, in London 2012, you're facing some stiff competition.
Tell
me
about
it.
Geezer.
From.
But these kind of word games can be beneficial beyond their entertainment value. For example, in the corporate sphere. Neil Malarkey actually does improvisation-based word games with managers in large companies as a positive team-building and creative exercise. Backstage at the Comedy Store, we can get a glimpse into the word athlete's mind. Are they wordy or numerical? Or both? Comedy Store players Suki Webster, Neil Ashdown and Phil Jupiters.
The reason that I do Sudoku and crosswords is to switch my brain off. I mean, it uses the brain, but it's a relaxation. It's a way of switching my mind off of conscious thought.
I'm not very logical. My mind works in a very lateral way, not in a literal way.
I like to do a crossword and then a Sudoku puzzle in the same hit. One is, like, full of puns and code and is very literary, and the other one is kind of a simple exercise of logic. And I like to do both, so maybe I'm a walking exception to the rule.
Compare and contrast the amount of sheer processing power needed to solve a cryptic crossword and a Sudoku puzzle. Professor Stephen Pullman, Professor of Computational Linguistics at Oxford University.
Sudoku is not very difficult. It's the kind of thing that computers love to do and can do very quickly and efficiently.
And cryptic crosswords?
There you have a combination of skills that are needed. You need facility with the language. You often need quite a lot of non-linguistic knowledge about the world. I heard a clue described on the radio the other day, and it was Cinderella's Midnight Music. I don't think we'll get a programme that can solve crossword puzzles, in the general case at least, in the foreseeable future.
Enigmatist Christmas Lanker, you started out as a physicist and set both mathematical and word games. Are they both, in a sense, a kind of code-breaking? Is that the skill that's being exercised? It's maybe no coincidence that Lewis Carroll was a mathematician and symbolic logician, and Alfred Butz, the architect of Scrabble, was in fact an architect. Is there some...
So spatial, and yeah. Therefore he likes grids and laying out... Yeah. Instead of just looking at the word as a unit, he'd like
to do
2D.
It's like a new way of looking at words that suddenly...
Yes. To me, maths and speech and so on feel like different countries, different parts of the brain. The lower level stuff, the algebra and so on, which is so mechanical, no, that's sort of logical and it's you follow the procedure and that's a bit dull once you've learned it. But the higher reaches is highly, highly creative and visual. Yeah. You get mathematicians sort of... talking in shapes and forms and almost talk about it poetically. So there is this overlap. Code breaking, what are you trying to do? It's a bit like the riddles. You're trying to find a form. You're trying to reframe all that junk. Yeah. Find a perspective from which you can see something which makes sense, like the Channel 4 logo. You go past at some particular viewpoint,
suddenly it
clicks
into
space, lines up.
Of course, the answer to Professor Pullman's musical crossword clue is what you're hearing. Ragtime. Now, remember how quick-wafting zephyrs vex Bold Jim? Here's what happened next to Bold Jim with the musical clue.
Jim just quit and packed extra-heavy bags for Liz Owen. Jackdaws love my bags. Big Sphinx of Quartz. Waltz Nymph for Quick Jigs, Vexbud.
And, of course, the Quick Brown Fox. Each line of our poem is a pangram, using all the letters of the alphabet as few times as possible, as we explained.
You've got pangrams, which is where you try to compose a sentence containing all the letters of the alphabet.
And pan pipes. And riddle of the Sphinx style, but with a Hungarian twist. 10 pulling 4, and what comes out?
Milk. You may not marry my daughter.
Oh.
Fry's English Delight was presented by Stephen Fry and produced by Nick Baker. It's a testbed production for BBC Radio 4, and there'll be a new series in the new year.